Welcome to the Deep Dive. If you've ever felt like modern art is some kind of secret language, well, we're here to give you the decoder ring.
That's the goal.
Today, we are strapping ourselves into a time machine. We're heading back to 1914 London to explore Vorticism. This was a radical British art movement that was explosive, audacious, and maybe most importantly, just incredibly brief.
It was almost less of a movement and more of a shockwave, really.
Yeah.
To understand Vorticism, you have to place it right at the epicenter of Europe's early 20th century avant-garde.
Okay.
It was born out of this fascinating collision. On one hand, you had the fragmented sort of intellectual geometry of cubism.
Right.
And that gets smashed against the furious, almost chaotic energy of Italian futurism.
Ah, futurism led by Filippo Marinetti. That 1908 manifesto, that was a love letter to speed, to violence, machinery, industry.
All of it. It was all about movement and dynamism.
Right.
But the Vorticist leader, the notoriously abrasive Wyndham Lewis, he was very quick to insist that Vorticism was fundamentally different.
And superior, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely superior to Marinetti's noisy spectacle. Lewis claimed Vorticism was more intellectual, more rigorously formalized, and crucially, more inherently English.
So if futurism was the car zooming down the street, Vorticism was, what, the engine block itself, all that condensed power?
That is a perfect way to put it. And the movement's name really helps clarify this. The name Vorticism was actually coined by the poet Ezra Pound.
Okay.
And he described a vortex not as the wild, swirling water, but as the silent center of the whirlpool, the point where all that energy concentrates.
It's that intellectual core amidst all the noise.
Exactly, the stillness in the storm.
And their launch, it was just so dramatic. We're talking June 1914, just 1 month before Europe plunges into World War I.
The timing is incredible.
And Lewis launches the Vorticist Manifesto in this magazine titled Blast. And it wasn't just the words that were provocative. The magazine itself was printed in this shocking, aggressive pink.
The color was an immediate visual assault. It told you instantly that they were not interested in, you know, gentle critique or quiet contemplation. They were there to tear down the established order.
Okay, let's unpack the core aesthetic then, because the ideology of Vorticism translated into a very specific visual language.
It really did.
And Lewis's canvas workshop from around 1914, 1915, that really showcases the movement's visual foundation, doesn't it?
It's the key text, visually speaking.
Yeah.
They completely rejected the staple subjects of British traditional art.
Right.
You know, no pastoral landscapes, no polite nudes.
Right.
And they focused entirely on the machine age, using these bold, clashing colors, sharp crystalline angles, and subjects drawn right from industry.
And Lewis made his manifesto match that aesthetic severity. The content of the Blast Manifesto was, well, it was truly savage.
It was. It could contain these long, often witty, but always brutal lists of things they intended to, and I'm quoting here, blast.
Suspicious.
Oh, things like France.
Yes.
Humor, sentimentality,
mm-hmm.
The entire Victorian period, which they just saw as soft and weak.
So they were gleefully destructive.
Absolutely. But they were also constructive.
Yeah.
At the same time, they published a list of things they blessed.
Oh.
Elements of England they admired. They blessed England for its ships, its steep factory walls, and its achievement as this relentless industrial island machine. It's a very conflicted nationalism.
You can't really talk about the movement without its founding moment, which came from, not surprisingly, just this outburst of pure bitterness from Lewis.
Right. It wasn't some quiet ideological birth. It was a professional divorce.
The famous Omega Workshops dispute.
Exactly. Lewis was working for Roger Fry's Omega Workshops, which aimed to integrate fine art into commercial design making, beautiful furniture, touch styles, that sort of thing.
And Lewis saw this as prostitution.
He did. The breaking point came over a commission for the Ideal Home Exhibition. It wasn't just a row over money, as you often hear. It was an ideological war. Could high art be sullied by commerce?
And Lewis's answer was a hard no.
A very hard no. He believed in the purity of abstract intellectual art. He refused to dilute it for the market. So he and several other artists just walked out. They founded the Rebel Art Center, and that defiant move immediately solidified Vorticism as the official anti-establishment British avant-garde.
And that center only lasted, what, 4 months?
4 months. But it was enough.
It's incredible. So much revolutionary work from such a short window and so much personal fury. Let's shift to sculpture, because we have to look at Henri Gaudier-Bresesca's Red Stone Dancer.
Yeah.
Carved between 1913 and 1914, it just feels like that pound definition, pure, concentrated energy frozen in stone.
It captures that vorticist ideal perfectly. It's carved from Red Mansfield stone, and the work has this incredible sense of raw, contained power.
The forms are so simplified.
To the extreme. The face is a stark triangle, stripping away any sense of individual story. It leaves only the twisting, bracing, almost mechanical movement of the body.
And what's fascinating is how he got there. He moved so far beyond, say, his teacher, Rodin.
He did. He was heavily influenced by African and oceanic sculpture, which he studied extensively at the British Museum. He saw this primal, simplified energy in those non-Western forms that aligned perfectly with the vorticist goal.
Form over representation.
Exactly. Ezra Pound even called the Red Stone Dancer nearly a thesis on pure form.
And here's where it gets really interesting for you listening at home. Gaudier-Bresesca had zero formal artistic training. He was just 19 when he started.
19. And yet he produced hundreds of works in just 3.5 years. He was the epitome of that youthful, reckless vorticist energy.
And tragically, that energy was extinguished with just horrific speed.
He was French, so he enlisted the French army in September 1914. Less than a year later, June 5th, 1915, he was killed. A German bullet through the forehead while leading a cavalry charge.
He was only 23.
23. To think that one of the corps members who symbolized this pure machine age vigor was killed by the machinery of war. Just as the movement was taking off. I mean, it's just profoundly symbolic of vorticism's fate.
That death really does cast a long shadow over everything that follows. Now, vorticism was so heavily defined by Lewis and the official signers of Blast, but there were these independent figures circling the group.
Right. People who captured the aesthetic without subscribing to Lewis's, let's say, dictatorial ego.
Which brings us to David Bomberg.
Exactly. He was invited to contribute to Blast. He exhibited with the vorticists, but he refused to officially join Lewis's inner circle. He was critical of Lewis's sweeping condemnations. Bomberg insisted that art must evolve, not just condemn the past wholesale.
He was trying to find a balance, and if vorticism typically celebrated the machine, Bomberg used that same language of abstraction to show its sinister side. You see this vividly in his work, in The Hold.
It's such a dark vision. The dock workers are reduced entirely to geometric shards, stacked like cargo. The human figure is virtually shattered by the geometry of the industrial space.
So it shows how the machine age doesn't just empower us.
It can literally dehumanize and erase us.
And we see that intense, complex abstraction in what many consider his masterpiece, The Mud Bath, from 1914. He was also just 23.
An incredible work. That swirl of white and blue geometric figures against a shocking red rectangular bath. And the setting is crucial here.
Tell us about that.
It depicts Shuzik's Russian vapor baths in Whitechapel, East London. These baths were heavily used by the local Jewish population, and the setting specifically references the mikveh, the Jewish ritual purification bath.
Ah, so it links spiritual purification, getting clean, with the intense, almost visceral cleansing power of the industrial city.
Precisely, that duality. Bomberg, who is Jewish, knew that space intimately. By reducing the bathers to these near-abstract shapes, he universalized the act of spiritual cleansing into a modern mechanical ritual. But the initial public reaction...
It's a little bewilderment, I assume.
Complete bewilderment. And there's that great anecdote about its public debut. A critic reported the painting was hung on an outside wall at his solo exhibition. It got rained on, baked by the sun, and was just ignored by people who didn't even recognize it as a picture.
And the horses.
Yes. Bomberg himself recalled that the horses pulling the number 29 bus would shy away when they turned the corner. It was just too alien, too radical for London.
And you see the early signs of prejudice, with some critics sneeringly calling him the Jewish vorticist, highlighting that undercurrent of exclusion even within the avant-garde.
And if Bomberg showed the sinister side of industry, we have to turn to Jacob Epstein's rock drill for the apex of terrifying machine worship.
This sculpture is genuinely haunting. Today, we mostly see the reconstruction of the original, which was this menacing plaster robot, half man, half machine, straddling an actual secondhand pneumatic drill.
And inside its ribcage, almost protected by the machine's armor, sits this tiny, delicate fetus. Epstein called it the armed, sinister figure of today and tomorrow.
That combination of a carved plaster figure and a found, ready-made industrial object, that must have been radical.
It was incredibly modern. And this technical detail must not be overlooked. This use of a ready-made industrial object actually predates Marcel Duchamp's famous bicycle wheel by a couple of years.
Wow. So vorticism was doing something that the rest of Europe often gets credit for first.
They absolutely were.
We spent a lot of time on Louis's ego and the shock of the male artists, but it's critical we spend some real time on the two women who signed that notorious blast manifesto, Helen Saunders and Jessica Dismore.
Their history has been so systematically marginalized, literally written out of the movement. It's a tragic story of erasure.
It really is.
Helen Saunders, by all accounts, one of the most intellectually radical voices, even deliberately misspelled her signature on the manifesto as H. Sanders.
Why?
To avoid embarrassing her conventional family. She was trying to soften the blow of her involvement. I mean, she was a pioneer working in non-figurative styles very, very early on.
And the shocking discovery about her work at Atlantic City just drives home how fragile these women's legacies were.
The 2022 discovery. During conservation work, a team found this incredible black-and-white abstract metropolis, which Saunders had exhibited in 1915, hidden.
Hidden beneath one of Wyndham Lewis's own portraits, his 1921 painting, Praxitela.
Yes. Lewis was, you know, short of money and materials after the war, so the simple, depressing explanation is he just reused her canvas.
But the symbolism.
The symbolism is devastating. It shows how women artists were literally buried beneath the legacy of the male leaders. We're talking about a significant work of early British abstraction, and Lewis just painted over it.
It's heart-wrenching.
And that's not the only loss. It's an absolute tragedy that no vorticist oil paintings by Saunders survive. Her sister, misunderstanding their value, reportedly used one of her abstract canvases to cover her larder floor until it just wore to destruction.
Unbelievable. The history we've lost.
And we see a similar pattern of loss and trauma with Jessica Dismore. Only two of her vorticist paintings survive. She contributed poetry and drawings to Blast, but her painting contribution is almost entirely gone.
Dismore's wartime experience was immensely traumatic, wasn't it?
Immensely. She served as a nurse in France and later as a bilingual field officer. That exposure to the front lines resulted in a severe nervous breakdown in 1920, what we'd now call PTSD. And crucially, her doctors advised her not to paint afterward.
She had witnessed the horrific reality of the machine age they had initially celebrated.
Exactly. And her story ends with profound sadness. She died by suicide in August 1939, just 5 days before Britain declared war on Germany.
Wow.
Her distress was attributed to her marginalization by the male-dominated art world and the imminent threat of another world war. It's just this poignant summation of how the movement's radical hopes were systematically crushed.
I mean, the essential truth of vorticism is that its explosive energy, its machine age optimism, it just couldn't survive the sheer scale of the explosion that was the First World War.
That celebration of industry was instantly nullified by mechanized slaughter.
Lewis himself served, initially in the Royal Garrison Artillery, and was later an official war artist. His painting, A Battery Celled from 1919, draws directly on his experience at Ypres.
And you can see the vorticist style struggling with the subject matter. The scene retains those hard geometric forms, the sharp lines, the fractured landscape, but now they are utterly horrific.
Right.
The forms represent mechanization as destructive, chaotic, and crushing rather than exhilarating. It was Lewis's final bitter turning point.
And while he went on to attempt an unsuccessful revival with Group X in 1920, his later trajectory became, well, increasingly controversial.
It did. And we should note, just impartially, that he published the first major pro-Hitler book in English in 1931.
Though he did later reverse his position dramatically, denouncing Hitler and anti-Semitism in 1939.
Yes. But his lasting impact on the history of vorticism was often negative due to that abrasive personality, the constant quarrels. It meant he dominated the narrative, often at the expense of other figures.
Like William Roberts.
Exactly. Roberts' own shift is so visible in his war commission, the first German gas attack at Ypres. He retained that thick, tubular cubist style, but the subject is pure, unvarnished horror. It's just mechanized slaughter.
And David Bomberg, who served as a sapper, a combat engineer, he saw his initial abstract vision of war rejected.
Utterly rejected. His first highly abstract version of Sappers at Work was rejected by the Canadian War Memorials Fund as a futurist abortion.
A futurist abortion?
Can you imagine? It forced him to produce a more literal representational version. That experience, plus the loss of his brother and friends, just completely shattered his belief in modern urban dynamism.
Which brings us back to Jacob Epstein's terrifying sculpture, Rock Drill, for vorticism's most potent physical epitaph.
Because after the war, Epstein systematically dismantled the original. He sold the drill, He destroyed the arms and legs, and he casts only the truncated torso, the torso in metal in 1916.
This symbolism is just heartbreaking, isn't it? The invincible machine man is gone.
Gone. All that's left is this defenseless, melancholy, truncated torso, instantly evocative of the wounded soldiers returning from the trenches.
And the tiny fetus is gone, too.
It is, marking the complete end of his faith in the regenerative power of the machine age.
So if you look back, Vorticism's active life spanned barely a year. Two issues of Blast and one largely ignored exhibition in 1915.
The war scattered the artists, destroying their collective spirit. It's a textbook case of an artistic ideal being instantly nullified by reality.
And you can see the internal dynamics of the group captured perfectly in William Roberts' very late painting, The Vorticists at the Restaurant de la Tour Eiffel.
Painted decades after the movement collapsed. It's such an interesting exercise in memory.
It is.
In the painting, the seven men dominate the immediate foreground, eating and talking. Meanwhile, the women Dismore and Saunders are relegated to standing far behind, almost symbolically in the doorway, observing, not participating.
Visually summarizing their marginalization, and the power dynamics were brutally enforced. Kate Lechmere, who was the primary financial backer of the Rebel Art Center, she eventually withdrew her funding after quarreling with Lewis, and she later dismissed Dismore and Saunders as merely little lapdogs who wanted to be Lewis's slaves.
Wow. So the forces marginalizing them existed even among the movement's patrons. The whole thing just embodies that pre-war hubris, believing they could control and celebrate the mechanical future only for that machine to turn on them.
It brings us back to Epstein's final bitter assessment of his mechanical figure as a terrible Frankenstein's monster we have made ourselves into.
Hmm.
But the discovery of Helen Saunders' hidden painting beneath Lewis's work, it provides a tiny sliver of hope.
A little bit.
That other lost vorticist works symbolizing the marginalized artists of the movement may still be awaiting discovery right beneath the accepted narrative. And that raises the question for you, the listener. What crucial history remains hidden beneath the powerful but incomplete stories we are told?
That is a deep thought indeed. The search continues.
That's our deep dive for today. Until next time.